Good evening. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be upon you, and God bless America. I would like to start with a brief description of the situation in Afghanistan, how Afghanistan got into this mess and how it became the breeding place and the jumping board for terrorism, being an Islamic country, and how this whole thing fits in the opposite at hand. So I would like to, you have heard a lot about Islam and you have heard a lot about Afghanistan, but what I'm trying to do is to merge these things, two things together, though each is a very vast subject to be explained. To give you a brief background of why Afghanistan became a safe haven for the international terrorism of which we have been affected so badly here in the United States, and that it caused all the consequences that we are seeing now and the present situation. Afghanistan is a very small country, and its history is traced back to 5,000 years ago, not under the name of Afghanistan, but that country, that environment has been there, and it has been in the crossroad of many cultures and civilizations, and many invaders came through that country and went off, and they were kicked out or they were forced out, but they left always a kind of ruins behind, like Genghis Khan and Timur Lane and the British invasion, and then the Soviet invasion, and before that, you know, it was also a kind of crossroad of many other imperial powers, like the Persians, the Turks, the Indians, and etc. So it is a mountainous country. It is a small country, and it has been always left as a kind of barrier between different powers. The invaders and the civilizations that went through, they left the country with some good things and some bad things. Cultural residue of different civilizations made the country a kind of melting pot of many civilizations and many cultures. But also it suffered from these wars and invasions, and it postponed its developments in certain periods of history. The geographical location of the country in the surroundings and the nature has made the country a kind of place to keep as a kind of barrier between various forces or various powers. And therefore, everybody was interested in invading Afghanistan, and it was easy for them to invade it, but nobody wanted to do anything in it and develop it, because it was looked upon as a kind of place that keeps the forces separate. Since the beginning of the Tsar's rule in the Soviet Union, they were dreaming of finding a way to the warm waters. As you know, Russia is a very big country, bigger than the United States in the North America, but it's a landlocked country, and it is the only route that they have to the ocean. It's the frozen North Pole. And so it was in the dream of their rulers to find a way to the warm waters. And so throughout the history, they have been pushing south to find a way to the waters of the Indian Ocean and to the Gulf area and places like that. So it was in their dream, and they always tried to push south, and they were looking for an opportunity. To make the long story short, in the early, let's say, 80s, 79, 78, they had this idea that the dream is getting near to be fulfilled by invading Afghanistan and pushing south. So for years, for about since the beginning of the communist regime in Russia, the Soviet Union were trying to establish some kind of friendly relationship with Afghanistan and Afghans and with the governments, and extending technical support and offering scholarship for Afghans to go and get training in military in other areas. And unfortunately, many governments of Afghanistan tried to limit their relationships with them, but the country was poor and needed technical support and extended their hands to the West, and sometimes it was rejected because of the involvement of the West in the neighboring countries, Iran and Pakistan. So their requests have been turned down, and the Russians or the Soviets were waiting with open arms for the request of the Afghans. So in the late 50s that happened, and the Afghan government of the time asked for military and technical assistance from the United States. It was turned down, and so the Russians got the request and treated Afghans with open arm and opened their country and their door and their banks and everything to Afghanistan, and tried to manipulate the situation and offered scholarships and trained military people and gave tanks and planes and all kind of arms to the Afghan government. And at the same time, they work on the ideology of the people. Those who have been given scholarships to Russia, they were for 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, and then they started building a cadre of people who will propagate the Marxist-Leninism idea in Afghanistan. And the country being poor and needy, had very little resistance to the temptations of receiving all these helps. And when in 1973, when the king left the country for medical treatment and went to Italy, the communists in Afghanistan and the Kremlin found the opportunity to be very suitable for a big move for the fulfillment of the dreams. So they established some kind of regime that helped the communist parties to take over. So they did take over, overthrew the Dawood government, who was the cousin of the king, who ousted the king and took control of the country and turned the country from a monarchy into a republic, called himself the president. And he served one term of 4 years, and the next term that he started, his first year, which was the fifth year of his term as the president, the communist elements around him had a coup d'etat and ousted him, killed his family, and then took control of the country. And then they tried to implement the Marxist-Leninist ideas, land reform and education reform and all kind of reform. But they tried for 1 year, and they faced some resistance from the public. So they invited the Soviet army. In 1978, the 200,000 troops of Russia invaded Afghanistan and occupied the country and supported the puppet regime, and then they committed all kind of atrocities and crimes against the people. They destroyed the country, the infrastructure, the education system by the name of reform. They did lots of damage to the established systems, and they, based on their policy of destroying the tradition and rebuilding the society, they did lots of damage. They bombarded the villages, they bombarded the towns, and they destroyed the system. And at the beginning, the West and the Europeans, and especially the United States, didn't indicate any interest in saving the country, because they said, Carter said in one of his speeches, that Afghanistan is of no interest to us. Our interest lies in the Gulf, and so we concentrate on protecting Gulf. And you know, and also there was this concept that whenever the Soviets go someplace, it is like an elephant. When it puts its leg there, it stays there, and the Soviets will be very hesitant to remove it. And also, they didn't you know, have any confidence in Afghan resistance, though they, in the history, Afghans proved that they keep quiet for a while. You know, it's easy to be invaded, but later on they rise up and oust the invader or the occupier. So Russians were facing resistance here and there, and because of the invasion, lots of people escaped. There were about 17 million people in Afghanistan before the invasion, and after 1 year of the invasion, the immigration started, and floods of refugees crossed the border and went to Pakistan and to Iran. About 3 to 4 million escaped to Iran, and about another 2 to 3 million went to Iran. And then when they went out, they started building resistance groups against the Soviet invasion. But at the beginning, they were well received in their struggle against Soviet Union. The Pakistani people and the Pakistan opened its doors and their hearts to receive them warmly as their Muslim brothers. In Iran, did the same thing, and so Afghans went there and formed their resistance groups, and they received arms and supplies very slowly. At the beginning, the West didn't trust them that they could do anything, so they started fighting with knives and axes and swords and things like that. And then later on, they received some arms from here and there, from Europe and United States, covertly and overtly. And then what happened in Pakistan, the refugees were put in the refugee camps, and the government of Pakistan assigned the affairs of the war to a department of the army, which is called Intra-Service Intelligence. It was a kind of CIA in the military of Pakistan, and they were made in charge of the affairs in Afghanistan, because it was a big task for the government of Pakistan to handle. So they assigned a military section to be in charge. And also the aid from the West, from the United States and from the European countries, they were not directed to the people of Afghanistan, to the Mujahideen or the freedom fighters directly. And the whole operation or the whole donation and financial support and military support was entrusted into Pakistan military intelligence. So they were running the show. And the Pakistani intelligence service had their own agendas for Afghanistan from the very early days. and they wanted to have influence in Afghanistan and influence in whoever was going to come and get into power. They were sure that the Afghans will defeat Soviets, but they were not sure that which kind of group will be in power and position. So when they registered the various the resistance, they didn't register them in one group. They registered them in seven groups under different names and different labels for the fear that if they get united, then Pakistan will be in trouble. By doing that, they created some kind of separation and favoritism among different groups, and one group received 35% of the foreign aid and arms, and another group received 12%, and another. Then the factions developed some kind of bad relationships and competition among themselves. And so when when the war was over, at the same time, other Islamic countries tried to help, like Saudi Arabia helped monetarily the Afghans, but also provided some fighters. What happened, some the Arab dissidents, some criminals, and some people who had difficulty with their own countries found the opportunity to do something constructive, for fight for the sake of Islam and against, you know, beside their Muslim brothers, against the invading communists. So they poured in from all corners of the world and to help the freedom fighters defeat Soviet Union. So things were going well, and the war against Soviet paid off. You know, the last straw was put on the back of the already collapsing communism, and the Russians were defeated, and they left Afghanistan, and Afghanistan was left with no leadership and with no support from the West. Once the goal of defeating the Soviets were achieved, then the West lost interest, and especially the big ally, the United States, terminated its support for Afghanistan in any form and shape, except a few, you know, $1 million in the $100,000 in the form of humanitarian help. And Afghanistan was left on its own with all the arms, with all the different people, and with all the criminals who found Afghanistan a safe haven. Most of the people who came from the Arab countries and the outside world wanted to go back to their homes, but their government would not let them go. And they all went to Pakistan. And then Pakistan pushed them back in Afghanistan and said, "We don't want you there." It just happened that among those enthusiasts were was this character, Bin Laden, that we all know. And he was one of those people who joined the forces, the Afghan resistance against Soviet, and he did well. He came from Saudi Arabia. He came from a very rich family, and he brought some money with him, and he helped during the war the Afghans and established himself as a kind of war hero among them. But when the war was over, he wanted to go back home. He went to Saudi Arabia, but he didn't get along with the government, and he didn't get along with his business partners, so he was kicked out, and he was stripped of his nationality. And then he wanted to go to Sudan, and he went there and worked for a while, and then he was kicked out. When he was kicked out, he came back to Pakistan. Pakistan said, "You cannot stay here, but I give you a passage to Afghanistan under the condition that you get all those wild people who are running around and causing a problem, you know, take them under your control." At the same time, all these factions who were fighting against the Soviet together, when the Soviet left, they turned their guns against each other. And as I said before, they had developed some kind of animosity toward each other because of the competition that was going on between them and receiving the arms and supplies during the war. And the Pakistani ISI was doing this thing. I should make one thing clear here, that the general public of Pakistan have been very nice and kind to Afghans, you know, and as Muslim brothers. And so was the Saudi Arabia at the beginning. But then after the Soviet defeat and the country, when, as I explained, became a safe haven for all these terrorists and factions, so the infighting went on. And then the other neighbors took advantage of the situation and each tried to help their own favorite factions and provided them with arms and money and supplies. So the war kept going on and the general public kept suffering. And the killing and looting and destruction continued. Till very lately, like about 6-7 years ago, and then a group of enthusiast Afghans, zealous Afghans in Kandahar, started to do something. People were sick and tired of the infighting and all these atrocities of the factions against each other and their criminal activities against the people of Afghanistan. And this group got together about 13, 14 very zealous members. It happened that some of them were students and some of them were former commanders. And they said, let's save Afghanistan. Let's help Afghans to get their freedom and let bring some kind of peace and tranquility in the country and start rebuilding. So the movement started under the label of Taliban. And it did very well in a few weeks or a short time. You know, people, they went around and told people, you know, that their purposes and their goals and their future achievements and things like that, people received them with open hearts and open arms, and they surrendered, especially the highways, you know, from Pakistan border to Kandahar. There were checkpoints and there were, you know, bandits who were robbing people of their property and the passerbys and everything. So they got rid of them and they maintained some kind of peace in Kandahar and the neighborhood, and they were trying to move to the rest part of the Afghanistan, and they had lots of success. Everywhere they went, people received them, surrendered their arms. The ISI, who had traveled with all these factions and traveled with these dissidents and traveled with chaos inside the country, they found that this Taliban movement was going to be very effective, and they were doing very well in the first a few weeks in their of their establishment, and then they decided to grab it, to hijack it, and in one of the meetings of the 14 members or 12 members, there was an agent, an ISI agent, who suggested that we are doing great, you know, we have had success, and we are gonna invade, we are gonna take over the whole control of Afghanistan. But we don't have arms, we don't have money, we don't have technical support. Unless we tie ourselves with an outside force and with outside help, and he meant to tie us, ourselves with Pakistan. And the members of the group gave a surprise look to each other because they found out that their plan had been exposed. They didn't want it to get exposed. They wanted to keep it national, you know, underground, and sort of till they get momentum. But the ISI took advantage of it right away, and before they said anything, some members left the meeting and didn't come back the next day, and some stayed around, and then came in the convoy of the Pakistani military intelligence with generals and food and arms and money and everything, and then the advisors, and then they were received with the by those 2-3 individuals, and then they were put on top of the meeting, and then they said, well, guys, you are doing great, I've brought you congratulations and best wishes from, you know, your former partners and supporters and brothers, And here is our token of sincerity and help and support, and there are these arms and these trucks and this money and this food and everything. But you cannot manage without having an organization. So you have to have an election, you form a leader, you one for Kabul, and then you have to form a council that goes to Kabul and one in Kandahar, and then you spread your representatives around the country with some kind of central organization. And so they held a meeting and they select the blind, one-eyed man called Mullah Omar. And he had some credits because the Pakistani major who advised the group and said, you know, this guy is going to be great because, you know, he's been injured, he suffered, he was a commander, he fought against Soviets, and he has a good reputation, and now he will be accepted, he was Amir. And they all voted, yes, this is going to be our Amir. And Amir means the leader of the believers, Amir al-Mu'mineen. So Mullah Omar, an illiterate man with very little education, was put on top in a symbol, in a kind of puppet. But then all these ISI majors and generals and technicians came in the form of advisors. They took the military over and the administration in Kabul and in Kandahar, and one by one got rid of the Afghan elements and used the label of Taliban as a kind of shell to be filled in with the Pakistani personnel, military personnel, and also at the same time Bin Laden was getting a little bit established with establishing its quarters for training people and bringing them under control. And so the ISI told Osama, why don't you take over the leadership? We will help you with tactical advice. You run the military and we give you the support. We have two agendas in Afghanistan, the ISI said. We have one political agenda, one economical agenda. We want to establish a regime which is pro-Pakistan and watches for the interest of Pakistan, which has an intention to establish trade with the newly independent states, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and all these people. And you also have an agenda to spread your version of restrict Islam in these new independent republics, which used to be Muslim and they were invaded by Soviet Union. Now it's a chance for you to go and propagate your version of religion too. So Osama people accepted this offer, and then Osama became the leader, the founder, the supporter, the king, the president of the so-called Taliban. And all Afghan elements were wiped out and replaced by Pakistani majors and generals and militia and also the Al-Qaeda people. So they formed an unholy alliance against the nation of Afghanistan, who had suffered for 20 years under the rule of communism and so forth and so on. And they've been suffering from the drought, they've been suffering from diseases, they've been suffering from the war and looting and rape and everything. And then this unholy alliance of ISI and Al-Qaeda brought another misery. So what they did, they turned Afghanistan in under the name of Islam into a concentration camp and deprived people from all joys of life. They closed the offices for women and said women should stay home and paint their windows. They are not supposed to be seen according to the rules of Islam. Women should not mingle with the opposite sex, and they should keep distance, and they should not be exposed. So they have to stay at home and take care of cooking and washing and cleaning of the family, and man has to go out and fight. And they closed all the girls' schools, and then they, under the name of Islam, they deprived people of music, TV, VCR, videos, newspapers, computer, internet, email, everything, and they helped people by the gun points. And they took the, you know, they formed a ministry, which was called the Ministry of Propagating the Virtue and Eliminating Vice, and under those strict rules, they made all men, you know, grow beard and go to the mosques by force and pray, and cut their ties with outside world. And at the same time, the foreign agencies who are helping Afghanistan with food and other humanitarian help, they said, you know, it is our country, we are in charge of distribution, you give us the money, you give us the supply, you stay out of it, we will take care of it. So they started hoarding and saving and piling all the food supplies that was donated by the rest of the world. And all this time, the West kept their eyes closed. Afghans kept shouting, you know, that don't let Afghanistan turn into a safe haven for these activities, for terroristic activities. And they were warned times and times, you know, that the Arab dissidents are here and the foreigners are here and the Chechenian opponents are here and the Bosnian opponents are here, and all these people are using Afghanistan as their training camps for terroristic activities and training terrorists, and you know, using Afghanistan as a launching board or a jumping board for exporting their terrorism to Chechnya, Bosnia, Kosovo, Kashmir, Philippines, Egypt, and all these places, because this Al-Qaeda belonged to a branch of Islam, which has been, you know, other than Islam, they have been everything else. This is a network which Al-Qaeda is only part of it. And they are using the name of Islam and like hijacking the Taliban movement. They are hijacking these beautiful concepts of jihad and concepts of being... you know, pious and being God-fearing and all these things under these names. They have been implementing their restricted, destructive activities in Afghanistan. So all this time, the West shut their eyes and let it go. And the Taliban, which I hate to call it Taliban because it always carries a name or a connotation of being Afghan, it was not Afghan, it had no Afghan identity, now it was this unholy alliance. And they were getting momentum and they were getting power and they were receiving lots of funds and arms and supplies, and the only group which was fighting against them and were able to fight was the Northern Alliance, which was an alliance, a shaky alliance. Several times it came together, then it fell apart because of the interferences of the neighbors. And so this Northern Alliance was the only group resisting the Al-Qaeda and this unholy alliance, but they were kept pushing back all the way and pushed to the north, and they were fighting with their limited supplies, and though they were receiving some help from Russia and India and Iran, but still, in compared to what Al-Qaeda was receiving from its supporter, it was nothing. And now we can see how strong the Al-Qaeda was as opposed to what Massoud was there. So finally, and around September 9, I think the Al-Qaeda plan was reaching maturity to hit the West, to hit the United States, but they also wanted to feel more secure from the Northern Alliance side. So two of the terrorists from Pakistan were sent inside Afghanistan to go and kill the only resisting Commander Massoud of the North, who never surrendered to the will of the Al-Qaeda or to the ISI. So the two people went under the name of the journalism, and they took a booby camera and killed the leader. So 2 days after that, they attacked the World Center, and which killed lots of these innocent people and destroyed our economy. And then America was awakened. And then they realized, you know, that we ignored this breeding place, and we let it go out of control, and now we are hit. So they developed a plan for attacking Afghanistan and getting rid of the Al-Qaeda and its network, and this break this unholy alliance. At the beginning, there were lots of shouts and screams about, because these are Muslims and these are our brothers and we cannot throw them out. But it was not Afghans who were saying this. They were all supporters of Al-Qaeda and supporters of ISI. And you could see on TV, you know, that there were pictures of Al-Qaeda, and there were groups of zealous religious students from madrasas and things like that pouring on the streets of Pakistan, shouting anti-American slogans in support of bin Laden. And while the occupation was going on, lots of the Pakistani madrasas, which are the religious schools, were recruiting new fighters and new personnel for the unholy alliance that they called Taliban, and exported them to Afghanistan against the general public under the name of jihad. Now I think it's a moment to talk about the how Islam has been used for in this context. Some of you know and some of you don't know, the Islam is the fastest growing religion in the United States. And contrary to the misconceptions, it does not teach terrorism, it does not teach hijacking, it does not teach, blowing up the buildings, it does not teach killing innocent people. And does not teach fighting against non-Muslims, non-believers, and it doesn't label the non-believers as enemies of Islam. According to Islam, mankind is a creature of the same Creator. This Creator created everybody differently, with different colors, different languages, different faith, different nationality, different values, different shapes and forms. But he could have created everybody the same. He could have created everybody Muslim. He could have created everybody Jewish. He could have created everybody Christians or infidel. He could have created everybody black or white or blonde. But in his wisdom, he decided, as he says in the Quran, and the Arabic verse says, "Ya ayyuhan nasu inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin aw unsa waj'alnakum shu'uban wa qabailan lit'arafu inna akramakum 'indallahi atqakum." This is a verse from Quran which says, God says, it addresses the mankind, not the Muslims, not the Christians, the mankind says, "O mankind, I created you from a pair of male and female and spread you all over the world and turned you into tribes and nations so you should recognize each other but not despise each other, not fight each other. And the closest of you to the in the sight of God is the most pious one of you." So this is a statement of Quran. So the whole creation is his creation. And in the other place, Islam says that there is no compulsion in religion. The the ayah says, "La ikraha fi din." There is no compulsion. You don't have to impose your faith and your ideas and your opinions on the other people of the other faiths and other opinions and a state. You have to respect them. You have to respect everybody because the guidance and the heart is in the control of God. He guides everybody that He wants. It is not your job. And He even told Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God told Prophet Muhammad, that it is your duty is just to convey the message and leave the guidance to me. You cannot guide the people. You just convey the message. Which message? The message that God sent to mankind, not just to Islam. The messages of God, when God created man and sent them down to earth, and then He didn't let them fumble in the dark. He sent instructions and guidance for them and teachings for them through the messengers in the form of revelations, in the form of holy scripts. So the message of God from the day first, which was revealed to Adam, to today isn't changed. It is the same message that worship the only creator, the only sustainer, the only master, and do good to each other. Be helpful. Do good and avoid the bad, or promote, as the Taliban used to say, promote virtue and destroy vice. And this is the message, and it has been all the same. Of course, people like Al-Qaeda misinterpreted and used it at different times of the history. But that is Islam. Islam is totally against killing innocent people. Allah says in Quran in one place, which the Arabic is, "Man qatala nafsan bighayri nafsin aw fasadin fil ard fakannama qatala an-nasa jami'a wa man ahyaha fakannama ahya an-nasa jami'a." Killing one innocent person without due process, legal process, is like killing the whole humanity. And saving one life, it's like saving the whole humanity. That's the teaching of Quran. The teaching of Quran is, Osama says, it is not killing the non-Muslims, killing Americans. This is what he claims, that our activity is against the non-Muslims. And unless we kill all Americans, we will not be sitting calm and quiet. And they don't know that attacking the World Center was attack on Islams as well as others. There were 300 Muslims in the building. There was a mosque in the second tower in the basement. And there are 7 million Muslims living in the United States. And when you look at those footages of TV in the Pakistani madrasas where the Al-Qaeda people are teaching, they say, "What are you teaching them?" The guy says very openly, with very bravely, says, "I teach them Quran, and I teach them that they should kill Americans when they grow." And this suicide bombing, telling people that by killing the non-believers and by attacking, and committing suicide, you will be going to Jannah, which is paradise. And this is another concept of jihad that has been hijacked by the Al-Qaeda and people like him, calling it jihad, the holy war. There is no holiness in any war. All wars are dirty, filthy, bloody. Why a war should be called holy? And plus, jihad is not a war against infidels, against other people of other faiths. It's not against innocents. Jihad is a struggle. It's a struggle of, the real meaning of jihad is a struggle of right against wrong, a struggle of freedom against oppression, a struggle of just against injustice. And it starts with a person himself, and then to his family, then to his neighborhood, then to the city, then to the country, then to the nation. When we are in constant struggle with our lowest wishes and desires, you know, our lower desire wants us to steal, to kill, to rob, to this, and then, you know, our good side says, don't do it. We have neighbors and who are committing some bad things, harming the community. Then we are struggling against them, preventing them from doing bad. And then in our country, there are groups who are trying to be destructive, and we struggle with them. Sometimes our governments are trying to do things which are not fair and injustice, and we struggle against them. And then our country is invaded by the outsiders, you know, who are attacking our values, religion, property, life. Then we stand against them, as Afghans, excuse me, stood against. That's jihad. Jihad is not to put 400 innocent people in a plane who all have families, who all have relatives, who have children waiting on the other side for them, to bring them gifts, to bring them, you know, supplies and supports, and put them in a plane and say, we are going to go to paradise because we are going to kill ourselves and hitting the building and killing another 4,000 people who are there to earn a living, to fulfill one of their obligations or provision for their families and earning their living and, you know, paying for the education of their children and for their health and clothes and shelter and all these things. And then they say, I'm going to do this because we are going all to paradise. There is no paradise for those people according to Islam. There is nothing in the Quran that promises paradise to those kinds of people who are killing innocent people and themselves. And life is a gift which is given to God, according to Islam, to individuals. And he is the only one who has authority over it. He will give it when he wants. He will take it anytime. Any kind of interference will be against disobedience of God, and it is subject to punishment by hellfire. And taking your life, which is a gift given to God, and he is the only master, and you taking your own life in your own hand, you go directly to hell. There is no chance for paradise. So they have been hijacking these concepts, are fighting against infidel, using the name of the jihad, struggle, and sacrificing yourself and killing yourself for the sake of paradise. These were all concepts that have been hijacked by this group of terrorists for their own purposes, and they are using religion. Afghanistan was the purest form of Islam, the most, moderate, the mainstream. And then they use the sentiment of the people, and the religion and the faith is always a strong tool in the hand of the people who want to manipulate it for implementing their own plans and gaining their own interests. So they use religion. This group of terrorists who are fighting under the name of Islam, they are not doing this for the sake of Muslims or for the sake of any Islamic cause. They are killing Muslims. Their activities are geared toward the Islamic countries. They killed Anwar al-Sadat. They created all kind of problems, in Algeria. They harmed the tourist industry in some of those countries by hijacking and by taking hostages and by kidnapping the tourists and causing problems. Their main purpose of this network, the global terrorism, is not America. It is not West. It is the whole establishment. They want to destabilize all the establishments, Islamic, non-Islamic, American, European, Egyptian, Moroccan. They don't care. They want to destabilize all these things and try to topple them down so they could establish themselves as the main power. And they also use this concept in Islam that Islam was once, in the early days, a dominating power in the world extended from Saudi Arabia to Spain, and the Al-Qaeda and its group and its network is trying to establish Islam again. So they are rejecting all the mazahib, all the faiths, all the other scholars, and they say, you know, we are following the old ways, the early concepts of Islam, which was used by the Prophet and his companion, and we are implementing that version so we could have this success to dominate the world. So there are these kinds of things, and this is where we stand, and this is because of what happened in Afghanistan. And now people say that, you know, the Afghans, when the attack started, they say the Afghans don't want their lands to be attacked, and they don't want, you know, they've been suffering from enough bombing and things like that. But you know, our contacts, direct contacts inside Afghanistan, they say it was a pleasant surprise. You know, there was this word that America is going to attack the terrorists inside Afghanistan and eliminating them. But the people of Afghanistan are angry because their territories and their land is going to be attacked. Of course, it hurts when your land and territory and your country is attacked. But when you are oppressed and suppressed and held by the gunpoint and your country is occupied and you are living a life of a concentration camp, you look for any kind of help to get rid of them. So when the first night of bombardment started with all the noises and all the shouts and all the rumbling of the jets and things like that, people crawled into the holes, and the next morning they woke up. They were expecting a bombardment like the Soviet bombardment that, you know, levels down everything, and they kept crawling out of their holes in the morning, and they looked at each other and they couldn't believe their eyes. Everything was intact. The city was there, the houses were there, the shops were there, the schools were there, and all those things. Only a few military installations were gone. And, you know, the tanks were destroyed and the armor vehicles were destroyed, but the people and their life was intact. But here in Pakistan, the pro-Taliban and the pro-Al-Qaeda raised hell, you know, that casualties and civilian casualties. And Afghanistan is suffering again and is hit again. And they want Americans out and this and that, while Afghans had no choice. They received this open-hearted. Of course, this was not Afghan war. It was American war, because this time America was hit. It was not like, you know, the Gulf, that we went to support the Saudi Arabia or Kuwait regime against Saddam, and it was not like Somalia. It is this time we got hurt here, and our own land was attacked. Our own economy was affected. Our own minds, our own hearts, our children, everybody is affected. So this is this war. But Afghans appreciated because there was no other way that they could get rid of all these, terrorist camps and breeding centers and schools. So now the president, the chairman is here, and he's here not to ask financial aid, because the financial aid has been already promised $100 million, but he came here to express his sympathy to the people of America, to the people of New York, and tell them that we are suffering from the same thing. We feel your pain, and, you know, because we have been living under these kinds of terroristic atrocities for a long time. But we want America to help us to eliminate these terroristic groups completely from Afghanistan, and not to stop there and also follow him, because there is only not one Osama. There are many, many Osamas, and there are 60 headquarters of this network spread all over the world, and there are 30 or 36 of them in the United States, which has been under surveillance since September 11th. And they have been under attack and surveillances, so they are taken care of. But now the people have escaped. And most of the leaders of the terrorists and the Al-Qaeda are living now in Pakistan under the protection of ISI again. And ISI took advantage of the situation, of the control, and you know, in one of the situations where all the generals and personnel of Pakistan was caught together with the terrorists in the north, and then they cut a deal with you know, American forces, give them a passage to evacuate, so they evacuate all the generals and majors and leaders of Taliban into Pakistan. Now they are in full protection of ISI, and you know, they are claiming on one hand alliance with America, and on the other hand, their sincerity, I think, is stronger toward the supporters of the Al Qaeda and the other things, other groups. So I've been given signals that the time is up. I stop here, but I would like to take questions. The idea came up several times in different conferences, and then the National Alliance have been talking about the Marshall Plan kind of thing for Afghanistan. But unfortunately, there have been some points like today or yesterday, you know, they said, we are running the war, and the other countries should take care of rebuilding Afghanistan. And you know, this doesn't work that way. This is not, as I said, an Afghan war. It's an American war, and Afghans are appreciative of the side effect of the war, getting rid of the terrorists and saving their country, but they still need American help. You spend $30 million a day in the war and destroying, and you know, spending $1 million a day for the reconstruction doesn't hurt. But America always holds back and see what the other do. You know, our project at University of Nebraska for 4 months have been fighting to get some money to start, the schools start in March. And they keep postponing and postponing and postponing, and you know, they say, wait till what the Japanese do. And then we wait, and the Japanese program, you know, the conference takes place over there, and in Japan pledges $500 million, and America pledges $300 million. Americans are, you know, famous for being impatient. You know, they say, okay, we had the war, we got rid of the Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, and we cannot find Osama or Omar anyway, bring our sons back home. And the opposition knows this thing. You know, there are these warlords in Afghanistan who are sitting back, waiting for that opportunity to, you know, to see that America suspends it helps, so they come back, and also the Al Qaeda and these people. So I would like to beg you and ask you to have patience. As I said, the Osama is not the only one. The network is expanded, and we have to go after them and to have peace and security permanently for us and for the rest of the world. We have to complete this task and have patience. Don't pressure the military or anybody to bring our sons back. You know, send your own sons again to protect our future generation. Thank you very much.